You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
We lost another notable American earlier this year when comedian, actor, and author George Carlin died. In June, the same month Tim Russert passed away. George Carlin was a guest on this show a number of times, the last one in October 2004 to talk about his book, When Will Jesus Bring the Pork Chops? In typical George Carlin style, he chose the title specifically because it offended three major religions, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. In his memory, we're playing that interview for you today. He opened his book with a page of epigrams, and one of them was from Hermann Göring. I began by asking George Carlin if there was any relevance to that in the light of the political situation of our time.
Yeah, it's one of the quotes I had saved somewhere along the way some years back in a little file called Quotes.
You have a clip, a little clip thing that you probably use for your to stimulate you when you're writing your act as well?
The notes I keep, I have about 2,300 files in my computer, files and subfolders and subfolders and subfiles. Everything's, I'm very, as it happens, very left-brained and organized and like indexing and classifying things. So,
and you also can afford to buy a lot of extra memory for your computer.
That's right. But the thing about my files is that they're I'm constantly updating them with new entries, new little things that I come across, that, you know, that I think of. Mostly it's my own stuff. But the quotes that strike my eye, I just save them for me, really. And occasionally as I look through them, I say, you know, that could be useful in another way. So,
and I guess I should I read the Hermann Göring thing, or do you want to read
it?
Why don't you read
it? Yeah, okay.
You know it by heart?
No, I don't. I have to.
It's long.
Yeah, it's about 7 or 8 lines. Quote, "Of course the people don't want war, but after all, it's the leaders of the country who determine the policy, and it's always a simple matter to drag the people along, whether it's a democracy, a fascist dictatorship, or a parliament, or a communist dictatorship. Voice or no voice, the people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. That is easy. All you have to do is tell them that they are being attacked and denounce the pacifists for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to greater danger." And that was Hermann Göring at the Nuremberg trials.
You say on your website, don't believe anything the Bush administration tells you. In fact, don't believe anything anyone tells you. So why did you undercut that first clause with the second one, considering your political leanings?
I don't know when I put that on that website. I don't remember ever quite saying that. Uh-huh. I don't maintain my website very faithfully. I find it very, there's no gratification in a website at all.
So somebody else is doing it. Stephen Wright complains that every so often people will quote back things they found that he quoted him on the
well,
web.
There are a lot
and he
of,
says, oh, that's such a bad joke. I never would have made that.
Absolutely. And I would like to take a moment to point out one of the things I disclaim on my website, that this is one thing that was important to me. There's a thing going around called I Am a Bad American, and there's another thing going around called Paradox of Our Time. And it's emailed by thousands and thousands of people with my name on the bottom of these things, and they're nothing like my way of thinking. So people who say to me, oh, that was wonderful, I say, listen, read it again, and do you really know my stuff or don't you? But I don't know what the fascination is for someone to put my name on these things that have been around for several years now.
But you have said that you're apolitical.
Oh, yeah.
You don't vote?
That's a fact. No, I don't vote. But and it's true. I mean, you can't really believe anything this administration tells you. That's probably true of more so this administration, because he apparently is a pathological liar by actual hearsay, let's call it, of his fellow students at Harvard and his professors there. He would deny something he had said minutes before. You know, I didn't say that. So there's a problem with him, but this is a highly secretive a lot of concealing going on in this administration.
But do you really think that the country would have been the same if Barry Goldwater had beat Lyndon Johnson, or George McGovern had beat Richard Nixon, or Al Gore hadn't lost to George W. Bush?
Well, the deck furniture would be arranged differently. There's no question about that. My point of view on this political dance is there's an ownership class in this country. There's a set of owners. There are maybe 800 or 900 of them, I think, if you were to count them all. They're the petrochemicals, the insurance companies, the real estate people, the pharmaceuticals, the oil companies. We know them all. They own the country. The politicians of each party are more or less bought and paid for well in advance, as are the judges. And the rest. Then there's this illusion of choice that we're given. Americans are made to feel free by the exercise of meaningless choices. And one of the illusions is that there's a substantial difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. Now my view is I tend to be left of center because I think left of center favors humans over property. I think the right of center, generally speaking, is more interested in property rights and ownership and the things implied by that. So I sympathize more with the left, and the average guy will get a better break probably when the left is in there. But it's a sort of a minor thing compared with the overall country's ownership and direction.
Well, that's kind of Ralph Nader's message, so why not vote for him? Are you afraid that people will yell at you the way they've been yelling at him?
No, I think voting is absurd, and I haven't done it since McGovern. I mean, I just don't I don't see the point.
He was the last guy you voted for because you actually wanted him to win.
Yeah, and that was a more romantic era in my life, as it were.
Much of this book deals with euphemisms.
Yeah, and about 60 pages worth.
Yeah, and that's something that you've become more and more interested in over the years. Mm-hmm. Was the interest in language, did that grow out of the other things that we've been discussing?
Oh, no.
Like the Department of Defense instead of the Department of War, things
right.
like that?
No, the essential interest in language that I have is genetic. My mother and her father, whom I did not know. I knew her, not him. My grandfather on her side, Dennis Beery, was a self-educated Irishman who came over here as a young man. And he wrote out in his lifetime most of the works of Shakespeare longhand, simply for the joy it gave him. That was his way of describing it. And he cared a lot about language, and my mother did as well, so she picked up that gene, and then there was the nurturing from her father who encouraged it in her, and she encouraged it in me when she saw that I had an ear and a feel for language and a taste for it. She would call me look at this, she'd show me an article, she'd say, look at these words, look how these words cut, look how that word cuts right through. And if I had a question, she would send me, of course, to the dictionary. So there's one sort of famous family anecdote where I asked her, I says, I'm not going to be able to think of both of the words. It requires two words. What does peruse mean? Peruse. She said, well, get the dictionary. So I bring the dictionary in and read the definition and use it in a sentence, and we talk about it for a moment. So the next night when I brought her World Telegram and Sun after work, she had come home and was relaxing, I brought her a newspaper, and I said, Ma, I said, would you like to peruse this? And she said, well, maybe I'll give it a cursory glance. So right back to the dictionary. So it was that kind of an atmosphere with my mother. And my father, whom I did not know, was also a highly gifted raconteur and a very, very successful advertising salesman.
And you've said that you work on your stand-up bits and hone it to the exact right words before you start performing it.
I'm a set-piece kind of guy.
But that's also because language is that important to you.
Yes, and getting it well, and comedy, in most cases, comedy requires a great economy of language to get the clutter out of the way of the joke and the setup and the point you're making. So I learned that some time ago, and therefore the craft of writing for myself, whether it's to be used in a book later or to be used in the stand-up, has always required, I guess, this skill for writing that I had, even though I wasn't very trained for it.
You grew up in Harlem, where you had to even be more aware of differences in language.
Yes.
You were in the Irish part of Harlem, which doesn't really exist anymore.
No, this was a little enclave here. Actually, it was just north of Columbia University and bordering on 125th Street. And it is called Morningside Heights by the university, prefers that to Harlem Heights, which was the original term. And we always called it, because we kids wanted to sound tough, we didn't like Morningside Heights, we called it West Harlem. But there was a little Irish enclave there, and we had a lot of Cuban, Dominican, and Puerto Rican, and blacks, very very close by. And I learned early that when you live at the intersection of two of these different kinds of cultures, people get along better because they have to. It's not like being isolated in the middle of one of them. So it was very cosmopolitan area because of Columbia University alone. And a lot of that rubbed off, and that was of interest to me. So, and then I had, after school, I had all time to myself. I could roam this borough at will and hear the voices, the Jews, the Italians, and the different people.
You were given a lot of freedom at a young age.
Yes.
And judging from your material, I assume that you began to question authority and social expectations at a very young age.
Yeah. I had an independent streak. First of all, as I say, because after school I essentially was my own boss. My mother had a very responsible advertising job, which kept her at work till around 6:30 or 7.
So both of your parents have been in advertising.
Yes. My father sold space and was, in fact, the national ad manager of the New York Sun for a period after being at the New York Post when it was still a broadsheet. Mm-hmm. And my mother was an executive secretary to the president of the Association of National Advertisers. So they were different segments of the advertising universe, but that was a fact. But
did they feel you were kind of a traitor? Because those were conservative newspapers, weren't they?
Well, I think when you're selling ad space, it does the editorial policy doesn't mean a lot. He came from Philadelphia, and he was self-educated as well. Everybody in my family. I quit school in ninth grade. My mother at least finished high school, to her great credit. But there wasn't a lot of formal education. So I learned a lot of things on my own. I have a good mind, and I had this independence that we started to talk about the authority. I had this independence per se in my life, this autonomy after school. So I began to be very self-reliant. And I looked inward, and I used my imagination a lot. And I, besides being self-reliant, I found that I could handle and take care of things for myself. So I resisted outside authority because I didn't really like rules that made no sense.
And then you enlisted in the Air Force, which goes against everything you just said.
Well,
doesn't
because
it?
At that time, the draft pool in New York for being drafted, because the pool is so large in the mid-50s, they didn't get around to you until you were in your early 20s. And I had a plan for my life. I had, by the time I was in my 20s, I had planned to be out working as a disc jockey. So I didn't want to have them just interfere arbitrarily with my life in the early 20s. I joined at 17 to get it out of the way. That's how the way people spoke about it then. You know, I've got my military obligation out of the way.
You went to Shreveport, Louisiana, and actually wound up getting into radio there.
Yes, I was a very lucky young man, at 19, I was working in the field. I had projected for myself, which was being a disc jockey. I wanted to be a DJ, which I thought would lead me to comedy, which I thought would lead me to acting. These were all ambitions I had when I was about 11 or 12. I made a little plan for myself. And so the whole thing was speeded up by virtue of the fact that I got very lucky, and I met the owner of a radio station when I was doing an amateur play in Shreveport.
And we'll come back to that and why you have inserted yourself into Da Vinci's Last Supper on the cover of your new book, When Will Jesus Bring the Pork Chops? George Carlin, published by Hyperion. We will continue right after this. Stay with us.
Thank you.
Today we're paying tribute to two notable Americans who died this past June. Earlier in the show, we re-aired an interview I did with Tim Russert, and now we're back with a conversation I had with George Carlin in the summer of 2004 when he stopped by to talk about his book, When Will Jesus Bring the Pork Chops? I asked him if he had another HBO show in the works at that time.
Next fall at the Beacon Theater, you and I mentioned the Beacon briefly, about WBAI at that time. At the Beacon next November is the number 13 show called Off Base and On Target.
The audience doesn't know what we were talking about, but many years ago, WBAI broadcast one of your bits, the seven dirty words, the seven words you can't say on radio or television. And it led to a case that went all the way to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
You did a benefit for WBAI, and I designed the poster that was sold as part of all of that. But it suggests that you have been pushing buttons for a long time. And on this book, you're doing pushing buttons again. The cover is sure to upset some people. You sitting in the Last Supper with a knife and a fork, one in each hand.
And an empty plate.
When will Jesus bring the pork chops?
Right. Well, that was my idea, that cover. I'm one of the few comedians who has Leonardo da Vinci as his cover artist. But I did suggest to them, I said, just do this. I said, if you can get the rights to one of the reproductions of the Last Supper, we can you airbrush Jesus out and drop me in. And I described what I had in mind. They liked the idea immediately, and they loved we all loved the rendering they did of it. So that's how it was born.
Religion is a big issue these days. Weren't you an altar boy?
Adam quile tificat juventutem meam, yes. I was an altar boy at camp, not in my parish here in Manhattan, though. But at summer camp, I went 5 years to a Catholic camp. I became an altar boy there. And I loved the Latin. And I loved the 1 year of high school I did have was Latin 1. And that's when you learn vocabulary and the conjugations and the declensions. And that basic ground floor part of Latin was so appealing to me. And I learned so much about language formation, the things that are obvious to a lot of folks, but that were certainly revelations to me at the time.
But I assume that you had bad experiences. Otherwise, why do you appear to be so angry with the Catholic Church?
Well, I don't experience it as anger. It's not part of the experience I have, so I don't like that word. I know it reads that way to people on stage or perhaps in the book. But I've tried to investigate this feeling. First of all, I just think religion has done an awful lot of evil in the world.
You compare in the book UFO enthusiasts and churchgoers.
Yeah, if the person reads that piece, I think it's called They Came From Out of the Sky. You see that in the media, for instance, when they talk about a UFO sighting or people who are at a UFO convention or the Roswell thing is raised again and there's some new evidence or a new person speaking up, they tend in the media to do all of this with a sneer and a snicker. The people who are interested in UFOs are not taken seriously. They're marginalized, as we do in this society, with people whose message we don't like. So they're marginalized and made to appear as kooks and buffs and so forth. Well, it's my contention that there is probably more. There's only a little of it, but there's probably more physical evidence for the existence of extraterrestrial observers than there is evidence for God's existence, and especially where the Jesus myth is related to. So I wrote a news story for this little piece of this essay in the book, which reads the way I think they should talk about Good Friday. That is to say, you know, Jesus buffs around the world today are celebrating the death of the so-called Savior who allegedly, you know, this and that. That's a contention of mine. But I wanted to get...
Well, have you become an atheist? Is that...
Well, that's a belief, too. And I don't like the tag necessarily. But I have no real... You know, I'm not an agnostic classically either because, I guess I am because it's true. I don't know what's going on out there. I tend to think that religion was invented probably out of a need. It goes back probably to animism, where there was a need where you could, but they could see the sun. They could see the sun make their crops grow. They could see the sun warm them in the day. They had evidence for the goodness of the thing they were idolizing, adoring, or whatever the right word, worshiping. But religion has, I think, has distorted a very natural instinct in man, and this is an important point in my own reasoning. We all have, apparently, when we've been differentiated at birth and given names and given identities, and we've been pulled away from nature, from the oneness of things, and we are egotized, given an ego and a name, I think people long to be reunited with the universe itself, with something out there. And I think this is a natural instinct people have, and I think it has been distorted and perverted and exploited by religion for their own purposes, and that's my complaint. And it's more like disillusion on my part than anger. I feel very disillusioned that I was betrayed as a young boy by this church that told me these things that aren't true.
I get the feeling that you, more than a lot of comics, actually base what you do on this philosophical search, a personal philosophical search. Most comics, you know, they say, boy, when I was in high school, I had a hard time getting a date, and then they do the standard stuff. Some of them are funnier than others. Or Robin Williams, on the other hand, he finds a way to riff on any theme that you give him.
Right.
But you seem to be trying to work things out, and then along the way, funny things occur to you.
Yeah, I found as a child that my mimicry, my ability to mimic people was a payoff, that the adults would pay attention and give me approval. So I developed these skills of being funny and being a humorous and liking jokes and liking comedians. But apparently there was this other strain in me of a sort of a fellow who had a lot of hunger for answers and a lot of curiosity about the world, and always looking for the side door, not the obvious entrance into whatever the building is we're discussing. I like to look for that side door and find a way in no one's expecting. And I'm kind of analytical. My mother once told me, she said, "You're like Uncle John. You have a very analytical mind. You like to look under things and find answers if you can." So the two things, the distortion that comes with humor, which is essentially a distorting medium. We look for something that we can twist out of shape, and therefore it's funny. The distortion element, along with the curiosity about these things, is what gives my writing now, which is not purely comedy anymore. A lot of it is sort of essays, and it gives it my own brand, I guess you'd say.
You, I think you were inspired by Lenny Bruce as much as any comic of your time.
Sure.
And it's always been a concern of yours to not sell out.
Mm-hmm.
And you have pushed the envelope, but there you've also done stuff
that's... I did the Perry Como specials, dressed up as Captain Cook.
And you watched your tongue, and you didn't say anything that was controversial.
Not in places where I'm not there to change their rules. You know, I understand they're selling biscuits.
But I wonder about... what your take is on the current situation. Mm. The seven dirty words went to the Supreme Court, and Pacifica lost that case, although there were some broadcasts were given certain little opportunities.
After 11 o'clock at night or something.
And now that seems to have been changed. The FCC is clamping down. We had CBS penalized rather heavily for something they had no control over, the Janet Jackson incident at the Super Bowl. And now we have Howard Stern leaving commercial radio to go to satellite radio because he's feeling constraints. Is the FCC citing the Pacifica case, the seven dirty word case, in clamping down now, or is something else happening, do you think?
Oh, I think it's broader than that. I think for one thing this past year, the administration has had a need to feed its, as they say, to the base, energize the base. They've made a lot of, perhaps not enemies, but they've lost a lot of support with the far right because of fiscal policies that don't sit well with a lot of people, and he has not fulfilled certain promises he made to the far right. So there's dissatisfaction over there, and I think in part to secure that and have a strong base so he could go back after the middle again, and the elections are such a wonderful game of strategies. I just love them for the you know, kind of like the game involved. I think they have gone and cut loose with their their call it their morality campaign. And in this case, they saw a few opportunities that were dropped in their lap. And it's part of a larger pattern of chilling free speech in general, and that whole thing that that Ari
Ari Fleischer,
yes, has said, watch what you say. I mean, it's just very apparent that I said a long time ago, we're already in a pre-fascist state, and when fascism arrives in America, it will not be wearing jack boots and brown shirts. It will be wearing Nike sneakers and hats that have a smiley face on them, and T-shirts with funny slogans.
But you've also said that audiences sometimes don't know how to take joking around about things. You did a routine about Littleton, Colorado, the school shootings there, I gather. And you said that it was a Columbine, yeah. And you said that the audiences just sat there. They expected something more reverential.
Yeah.
And
I don't like being manipulated emotionally by expectations, by media dictate. We're supposed to all think of Columbine and Oklahoma City and all these things as terrible tragedies, and there's these fences with the teddy bears and the ribbons and everything. This is emotional kitsch. America is full of emotional kitsch, and I, in order to show my displeasure with it or distaste, I take a very hard opposite tack as opposed to just being quiet about it. I like to just pull that rug out from other people and say, you're not paying really attention here, folks.
And when you are irreverent, do you find some audiences in certain places are more responsive than others?
Well, I have pretty much at this point, as you can understand, I earned my own audience, and there are exceptions. There are probably fringe exceptions. I would tend, even in a conservative region, and I work small and middle-sized markets all through the Midwest and all the areas where one would say, gee, he doesn't seem to fit there. But first of all, there's been a great homogenization of people in the country through travel and television and so forth. But I have earned the people in that town, that conservative little community. I am going to draw the ones who are the farthest to the left there.
So it's almost like when the Grateful Dead toured the country, or I'm sure there are other bands, but I think of the Deadheads. They just attracted certain people, no matter where they were.
Yeah, I have people who like my comedy and the ideas. I've always said I believe it's important to be funny. In my case, the way I describe my own task, to be funny is the most important thing of all. Good, strong, solid jokes, frequent. But I like then an undergirding of ideas. I like to know that there's good things underneath that are reliably, if not provable, they're at least arguable. And I read once Arthur Koestler, of all people, in The Act of Creation, talked about a triptych. And he said, the jester begins as just the jester making jokes. He says, if he then has a point of view underneath it, a philosophical point of view, he becomes also a philosopher. So he's a jester and a philosopher. And then if he does all of this in sort of a dazzling language, he's a poet as well, and he's transcended the triptych.
And that's been your goal?
It always stayed with me, and when I saw it in myself, I didn't have to aim for it or try too hard to have these things surface. I felt justified in a way. I felt that there was a kind of an intellectual precedent for doing what I was doing.
But none of it works if you don't come up with those jokes.
Yeah, that's the first obligation. And I have my stuff. I'm telling you, about every 8 or 9, 12 seconds, I got a good solid laugh, and I'm proud of that.
Yeah, how hard is that to pull off? You spend a lot of time writing. Assume that you think of yourself as much as a writer as you do a performer.
In fact, in my earlier years as a successful comedian even, I always described myself as a comedian who writes his own material. Now I realize I'm a writer who performs his own material.
But unlike so many other comics who've come through a similar situation, mm-hmm. You appeared in a lot of films. Mm-hmm. Continue to do more stand-up than the rest. Robin Williams does movies, usually serious dramas that get bad reviews. But when he does stand-up, it's only a special occasion. Yeah. You're out there.
I do about 100 concerts a year in theaters of about 2,500 seats average. I'm proud of telling people that I managed to sell about 250,000 tickets every year. And then I turn that into an HBO show every 2 years, and that becomes a DVD and a CD and all those things.
But why not go the other way?
Well, because
isn't there more money in just doing one movie?
I don't know the answer to how it would have worked, but I know this about myself. I found out along the way when I thought this was a journey from to be briefly a disc jockey so that I could be briefly a stand-up so that I could then become Jack Lemmon or mm-hmm. someone of that type, that I wasn't very good at that, at the acting. I did not have it was not my birthright. I just thought I could walk in there and would come naturally. It was very challenging and frightening, and I realized later what it did is it took me out of my autonomy, because there's a writer, there's a director, there's people, and it's an interpretive art, it's not a creative art. So I was lost for whatever reasons, and I didn't identify them well then, and I was sort of forced to stay on the road by tax trouble. That was another thing that happened later in my career. And I discovered by being on the road many, many, many nights and putting a deadline on myself that every 2 years I'll be ready and I'll do an HBO show, that turned me into a pretty good comedian and a good writer, very productive at least, very prolific. So I took pride in that, and now that's the most important thing.
That keeps a lot of fighters going longer than they would like. They have tax problems and they continue to fight.
Yeah.
But at least you don't have to worry about keeping in shape, and you don't have to worry about being knocked out.
I'm at the height of my powers. I'm 67. I've never written better. I've never had better shows. So I'm proud and happy.
On the other hand, you were in The Prince of Tides. You've been in
yes,
other dramas.
Yes.
And you did very well. A number of dramatic actors have told me that the comic roles are the most difficult, that they have a harder time with that than they do with the dramatic roles.
I understand. I can see why. I don't think I could do a very good job with them either, because they are, after all, going to be done over, and we're going to do that again, and the lighting wasn't right, and somebody dropped a pen on the side or something. It's there's too much going on for me to be able to really care a lot about that. But now when I had a chance to do Prince of Tides, it was a serious emotional part. It was a small scene or two, and I felt I could bring something to that, and thank goodness Barbara Streisand gave me the freedom to do that. But most of the time they just call you, they're just looking for another name they can add to the marquee.
That's why you were in the Bill and Ted movies?
Yeah, that was...
And often they cast you as the hippy-dippy guy.
Yes, of course. I can't tell you how many times I turned on people and said, listen, we got a nice idea for a series. You used to be a liberal hippie, and now you're a professor, and you've turned conservative. Or you're still a liberal professor, but you have a daughter who's very conservative. And it's just no thought, not much thought.
Well, since you're a writer, can't you say to them, look, I'll write you something that's a lot more interesting?
In theory, sure, but the trouble is they're selling biscuits and tires and beer and automobiles, and you cannot be yourself that way. I found that out with my Fox experience. I went there in my mid-50s. I thought, well, I'll try one time to do a sitcom based on me and my identity. And, it was close, not even real close, just close. But there are too many other people looking over your shoulder. There are too many other voices. It's not a creative act. So I was quickly, I lost interest in that, and the glow went off it very, very easily. And I said, well, I'm lucky. I have HBO. I have albums. No one interferes. There are no commercials, and there's no content check.
Didn't I also hear that you were going to do a Broadway show?
Well, at some point, and later, it will come later, because Broadway isn't much of a career move for me, and I am very conscious that I'm in the height of my productive years.
But Robin Williams does them, and Whoopi Goldberg.
Well, Robin Williams did an HBO show called On Broadway. They used the word Broadway as a prop. I told Broadway, HBO, I said, if I do this show someday on HBO, on Broadway, I said, it is going to be a real Broadway show because it will have a run, and it will have a theme, and there will be an intermission, and it will be an actual show. One person, one man, call it what you like. It will be more like a Broadway show than just me taking my act geographically to Broadway. So I have in mind at some point to do a show called New York Boy, George Carlin, New York Boy, where I would talk about, reminisce on my first 20 years of life, being conceived at Rockaway Beach and then being born in New York Hospital, being raised up with the Upper West Side, and being free to roam this wonderful city from 0 to 20, and to a boy who was stage struck, lived in New York in the 40s and 50s, and was raised by a mother who was language conscious. Those would be the themes and the threads I would pull together.
And growing up in the 40s and 50s, so growing up when New York was, many people say, at its peak.
Yeah, and when this country reached its ideal, its peak. I think it really went downhill fast after the 50s, after, let's say, 1950.
On the other hand, you say you're at your peak right now, so that's pretty good.
I feel good about it.
The book, for all of you art lovers, has a painting by Leonardo da Vinci on the cover with George Carlin as part of it. We know Leonardo was prescient, so he probably knew that you'd...
That's right.
...that you would come along sometime. The book is called When Will Jesus Bring the Pork Chops? It is published by Hyperion. What a pleasure.
Thank you. Could not thank you enough for always liking these intelligent interviews and conversations, and I thank you.